For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. True to their word, lawmakers end the 2018 legislative session 3 weeks ahead of schedule, shortly after passing a $7.6 billion budget and a bevy of controversial bills. Ryan, what did you think of the session overall?
Well, you know, you want to congratulate them somewhat for passing revenue bills, because that seemed, until this session, something that was totally impossible given the political dynamics that we've seen out at the Capitol in the last, you know, really political, in the last decade, maybe the last generation. I mean, the idea that we could raise taxes to fund government properly, you know, seemed to be an anathema, and that happened. I mean, well, we're not funding government properly yet, but we have raised taxes. You know, at the same time, if somebody comes and sets your house on fire, and then they show up with a bucket of water and throw a bucket of water on it, you don't break your hand patting them on the back. Yeah, so let's. I think that, you know, we can congratulate them for taking some positive steps in the right direction, but let's not confuse that with an overall shift in what's happening at the Capitol, because we saw in that last week the number of pieces of legislation that did everything from discriminate against political minorities in the state of Oklahoma, create insane gun laws that are now on the governor's desk. You know, they're not totally out of the woods in terms of, you know, bad legislating. So if we're giving grades right now, let's say a C.
Well, it's just better than previous years. Neva, what did you think of it?
Well, I agree that it was a tumultuous session. No surprise. I think we all knew it was going to set up for that. No one could have envisioned the ending the way it came with the teacher walkout and just the general backdrop that we saw at the end. And I think it spoke volumes about the fact that the overarching need in the legislature, in my mind, still remains that we need more civility. I mean, we have an atmosphere that is so contentious, that is so negative and hostile, literally hostile in some measure, that it's counterproductive to be able to, regardless of, you know, who's in charge, regardless of leadership, regardless of all of that, you still have to have an environment where people can legitimately try to thrash through these very difficult challenges that they face and will face next session and beyond. And I think that to me is the takeaway, that if they can look at this session and say, yes, we can do some difficult things, yes, we can meet some of these problems head on, not necessarily that everyone's going to like the outcome, but at least get the ball moving in the right direction, I think that would be the positive out of it. Overall, I mean, you certainly can't give them an A. I mean, I would probably be a little more generous this session than I have been in some previous sessions, and say that it probably is a B-, because I think that they were dedicated to the idea that they had to get some results, and whether we like all of them or not, I think that we have to give them some real applause to a limited measure on what they did accomplish.
Well, I don't think Ryan's ever given them over an F. So, in fact, they gave him a C is actually...
Oh, I thought it was a D- once.
I may be given a D-. But 2018 will be the year of the teacher walkout. Mm-hmm. You know, this legislative session will be remembered not for something that the legislators did, but for something that the teachers did. And the walkout is historic, and that's the thing that I think folks, whenever they look back on the session, that's what they're going to remember. It was the turning point in the session. I think that, you know, the fact that they did get out early, that they passed a budget when they did, all of that, I think, was in this context of the pressure that the teachers put. And Neva was, you know, she was talking about civility. I think that's absolutely right. I watched civility break down, not just across party lines, but among Republican members themselves across the Senate and the House. Mm-hmm. You know, people getting mad at other people because of tweets that they made, and then, you know, not hearing legislation. I mean, just all sorts of petty nonsense, you know, and that's got to change.
Right. It reminds me in the inaugural with JFK when he said the famous line that civility is not a sign of weakness. And I think some of these folks need to be reminded of that they can go in, have a hard fought battle, but at the end of all of that skirmish, they need to be able to walk away and come back and hopefully have some rapport and some ability to kind of get beyond this wild fire idea that they've had. But to your point about the teacher walkout, I think that that instance of the teacher walkout sets up for a very big question in my mind about what happens next session. If we're going to continue to have this shrill, kind of elevated rhetoric on education with not all facts and a lot of hysteria, that's not going to serve the education community well. It's not going to serve the legislators and the chambers well. And so I would hope that the takeaway from this would be there is a process, there is a reason to have the dialogue between all of these parties, but it doesn't need to be at the level that it wound up at the end of this session.
I do want to ask the other question for either of you: are the lawmakers done for the year?
No. I think that certainly not if medical cannabis passes in June.
Right.
If that passes in June, I think that lawmakers are going to have to do something to respond to the regulatory issues that have, at the very least, have arisen since the ballot question was written. I mean, the Department of Health is in no situation to regulate or administer a medical cannabis program. And so if that passes in June without any legislative action, we're going to put this incredibly important program in the hands of an agency that simply isn't ready to do it and doesn't have a regulatory framework to do it. They'd have to create that in addition to everything else. So if medical cannabis passes in June, I think lawmakers have to come back. They have to do something.
And I can see them coming back, but I think it will be very limited to just that. I don't think they'll allow themselves to get into some extended session where a lot of these other issues, whether they've been vetoed or what, you know, whatever kind of is the backdrop to kind of spark some other controversy and other issues. I don't think they're going to have an appetite to do that at all.
And we'll know as we get closer to that vote on June 26th. Governor Fallon has hundreds of bills still on her desk. Some of them have been signed, including asking the federal government for a waiver to put work requirements on Medicaid recipients, canceling the Ethics Commission's so-called cooling off rules on how long a lawmaker has to wait before becoming a lobbyist, and a bill expanding stand your ground laws to churches. Neva, what are your thoughts on these bills signed so far?
Well, I think it's interesting. On the Ethics Commission, it was not surprising to me. I mean, there had been certainly a lot of rift and a lot of controversy on what many perceived in the legislature, lobbyists, and even folks just watching it from the outside, that there had been this real overreach by the Ethics Commission in terms of their interpretation and what they were seeking to do, and becoming a much more kind of overarching and punitive regulatory entities, so to speak, on the process with the candidates and the Ethics Commission filing. So it'll be interesting to see long term whether we see some change just in attitude on that board and with the folks on the Ethics Commission staff itself. But to me, it was not surprising. I think the Medicaid requirement that was signed by the governor, you know, something the Trump administration's touted, something that there was a lot of support among, the Republican rank and file in the legislature. So certainly not something that was a surprise, but there are some issues there. And I think, you know, the folks that are the opponents to that have raised some issues that, have some validity, and we'll just have to see how it kind of shakes out.
Ryan.
Well, the Medicaid work requirement legislation, I was really surprised to see the governor sign this because it's based on so many false assumptions. I think that it's more based upon this political psychology of needing to feel superior to someone. It's like the governor and all of her pals are at the country club leaning over the shoulders of less fortunate Oklahomans saying that they would make better poor people than they are, that they'd make better life decisions, and that they need to just get out and get a job. You know, they're lecturing these struggling families of Oklahomans and telling them to struggle a little bit more so that the 1% in Oklahoma can feel less resentful about the table scraps that they're throwing them. You know, this is, the large number of folks that are on Medicaid right now are working. And let's be clear, Medicaid is not a jobs program. That's not what it's intended to do. It's there to provide health care so that people are well, that their kids are well, and they can get up and go to work and take care of their families and live their lives. You know, the condescension leveled at the poor in the state by Republican leadership ought to be enough to help poor Oklahomans realize that the real threat to their security, it's not undocumented immigrants, it's not the lack of a Ten Commandments monument on your local courthouse lawn. The real cause for the anxiety are the Republican majorities in the state who throw out social issue dog whistles on the campaign trail while cutting the throat of the poor when the election is over. And that's the pattern that we've seen over and over, and you can set your watch by it.
And I don't think the bill itself was really really trying to be that stark or that harsh as you're portraying it, Ryan. I think it is a philosophical difference in terms of, you know, allowing the requirements for the food stamp eligibility to be applied to the Medicaid recipients. I think people, by and large, in the public, want to see the folks that are less fortunate, that are in need, that need services, to have those provided. I don't think there's that stark a divide that we want to have the haves and the have-nots. I do think that when you get to issues where you have government, you know, monies being used, that there always is this difference of opinion, I think, and sometimes party-driven and ideologically driven about, you know, where do we kind of draw the line, and where do we make sure that we're being responsible in terms of everybody carrying their fair part of the load?
But with the Medicaid work requirement, one of the things we've seen there is that the administration of the program itself can actually cost the state more money. It could end up costing rural hospitals money from folks walking with uncompensated care. And all that's built upon this narrative. You know, so you've got all these facts that demonstrate that just the money and the savings aren't there with legislation like this. But there's this narrative that people that are receiving government services are receiving government services because they're lazy. I mean, that's been a political narrative that's been around since the 80s. And, I think less and less being advocated
or talked about. I don't think that's
Well, it's just subtler now. And well, I think that yeah. now we talk about it through things like Medicaid work requirements instead of beating up on folks on welfare. Right. And the Clinton administration did that as well. And frankly, the welfare requirements, you know, that came under the Clinton administration was devastating to poor communities around the country. So this, you know, beating up on poor folks for political points isn't limited to Republicans.
Yeah. Governor Fallon did also veto a bunch of bills here in the past week, including recognizing Native American Day on Columbus Day, moving the Commerce Department into the Lieutenant Governor's office, and streamlining third grade reading tests. In fact, the last one garnered some harsh criticism from Superintendent Joy Hoffmeister. Ryan, your thoughts on some of these vetoes?
Well, vetoing Indigenous Peoples Day and recognizing Native Americans in the state of Oklahoma was just, I don't even understand that. I mean, the Cherokee Nation is rightfully very upset that the governor said that she's not going to move this day to be recognized in concert with Columbus Day. I mean, it doesn't take it away. I mean, frankly, we should get rid of Columbus Day, but it doesn't do that. And then the governor is saying, well, she didn't want to, you know, hurt the ability to recognize Indigenous people in Oklahoma. Well, the tribes in the state of Oklahoma, the sovereign tribes in the state of Oklahoma, wanted this. Representative Chuck Hoskin, a member of the Cherokee Nation, an official within the Cherokee Nation, and also a state representative, carried this legislation. And, you know, so for her to say, well, you really don't know what you want, that veto to me, I just left me scratching my head. I really don't understand that. And I think that the same is true with these reading sufficiency tests. I mean, you had a bunch of experts that put this together. The legislature, you know, deferred to the expertise of these technocrats that sat down and wrote these requirements. And then part of the folks that put that together were from the governor's team itself.
Right.
And now
yeah.
the governor vetoes it. And the education community is kind of scratching their head saying, why does she do this? I mean, those two vetoes in and of themselves, I just don't understand the thinking there.
Neva.
Well, I think it's interesting in the veto. I mean, Governor Fallon on the reading question. I mean, she made it clear that this had been one of the things she wanted to be her legacy. I mean, in terms of
the RSA, the reading
the RSA,
yeah,
yes. Right. And so making it one of her chief priorities since she's been in office. And so I think it was a surprise to many, given the fact that it had sailed through the legislature, given the fact that the education community had been so strong. But she said, look, I mean, what it creates is a pass or fail system. And her point was that it really kind of masks student performance, that it didn't really embrace the notion of having parents and stakeholders and community leaders involved in being able to see what was really happening. A very legitimate point, not one that's well received among many in the education establishment and among that crowd. But I think she really, I think she kind of sent a pretty strong shot across the bow at these folks, including the superintendent, who came back and said that this was kind of a shallow understanding and kind of made some veiled, counterpoints to that, maybe not so veiled in her remarks. But I think the long and the short of it is we see that this is an area where we're always going to kind of move slowly and kind of have a back and forth. But the governor, she staked her ground and made her point, I think, very clearly in her veto message.
Meanwhile, there are still, like I said, like 100, 180, something like that, bills on her desk. Are there any, and of course we're recording this Thursday morning, so anything could change within the next 24 hours. Are there any bills that you're still keeping an eye on?
permitless carry, the legislation.
Yeah, constitutional carry. Yeah,
well, let's not call it constitutional carry because you that's what folks call it. Yes. But I think it's important. It's an important distinction. I know that sometimes us liberals, we get in trouble for semantic arguments. But here I think it's important. You don't have a constitutional right to carry a gun without regulations or restrictions. Even the most recent Supreme Court decisions and case law that has interpreted the Second Amendment doesn't say the Second Amendment allows you to just carry whatever gun you want, wherever you want, anytime you want.
It's a well-regulated militia.
You get to well-regulate. It's right. Well-regulated. There are reasonable regulations that do meet constitutional muster. So the idea that constitutional, if you need constitutional carry, then you don't need legislation to enact it. If you really believe, and I've challenged lawmakers to this, if you really believe the Constitution allows you to just carry a gun wherever the heck you want, go do it. Get arrested or fined or cited, and then go challenge it in the courts. They won't do that because they know they're wrong. But it's permitless carry. It's just a radically dangerous idea. And then the other is Senate Bill 1140, which allows adoption providers to discriminate against LGBTQ Oklahomans, parents and children that could be in the adoption system. The fact that the governor would, Representative Hoskins says, slap the 38 federally recognized tribal governments in the face by vetoing just out of hand, this legislation that created a day recognizing Native American Day in Oklahoma, that she would just veto that. And that we've still got permitless carry and this bill sitting on her desk, those should be the easy vetoes.
Right. Now, actually, she doesn't necessarily need to sign them either.
Right.
She could just do nothing.
Right.
Yeah, pocket
and
veto.
And they become
right.
a veto
yeah.
by right. the end. So.
And I think a very real possibility on that. I mean, it's interesting.
It's easier to do that. You don't have to put your name down.
And on the permitless carry, I mean, there now have been so many groups and so many voices that have come forward about the fact that it is such a flawed bill.
Including the Oklahoman.
The Oklahoman, I think when you listen to just the one point from the law enforcement perspective of when you have a police officer that can step up to a vehicle and would no longer be able to ask, whether someone has a weapon in the vehicle, where now, I mean, if you have, whether you have concealed carry or you just have it in the vehicle, you are required to disclose that to the officer.
Right.
I mean, just that one point alone, I think for many people who initially might have been persuaded to kind of move into the thinking that this was okay, see many of the flaws to it. And hopefully, if the governor doesn't veto it, frankly, I hope it is a pocket veto because this is a bad piece of legislation.
The state Supreme Court declares Oklahoma's voter ID law constitutional. Justices say the measure doesn't restrict people from voting because even without an ID, Oklahomans can still fill out a provisional ballot and voters can use the free identification provided by the state election board. Neva, were you surprised by this ruling?
I really wasn't. I mean, I think the fact that it's very clear that it doesn't impede the ability to go to the polls and to vote, that it is constitutional, I think was not a surprise. And really, when you read it, I think they were very clear in their outlining of why they came with that point of view.
Ryan.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised. I think that the Supreme Court was poised to make this decision. This has really become a political fight more so than a legal fight, especially whenever you have these legal safety valves like a provisional ballot and a free voter ID. I mean, if those two things weren't there, I think you'd have a much bigger
problem.
Right,
they've been actually shot down by certain other Supreme Courts.
So with those two legal safety valves there, I think this made for a very difficult challenge. It was going to be an uphill fight to begin with. Most legal observers anticipated that the court would uphold the voter ID law. And when I say it's become more of a political fight than a legal fight, the political fight, that doesn't mean that we just walk away from voter ID and say, well, this is the new regime. Because again, much like the Medicaid work requirements, it's built upon this narrative, that just simply isn't true. And right now we've got two different narratives. One, voter fraud. But if you look, study after study after study has demonstrated that voter fraud does not exist, in the way that the authors of these legislations tell us that it does, and even to the extent that it has been found, voter ID laws wouldn't cure it. And then the other is this idea that we've got a bunch of non-citizens voting in elections, and we've got to, purify the election process. And part of that, I think, goes back to this Obama birther phenomena that we saw started with our now President Trump. and has been carried out throughout the legislature. Both of those narratives are just wrong, and they're built on dangerous assumptions about who does and who doesn't get to participate in our democratic process. If we're going to do anything with elections, we should be making it easier for people to vote rather than creating restrictions based upon lies that make it harder for people to vote.
You know, it's interesting, though. I think we have to remember that in 2009, when the lawmakers put this state question on the ballot, 74% of Oklahomans were in favor of this. So, I mean, there's the notion that there's some kind of attitude out there that this is that this is not something that is completely valid and should be put forward, I think is bogus. So I think the courts, you're right, Ryan, no one was surprised, I think, in the overall picture. But I don't really see this as something going forward, particularly in Oklahoma, where we've seen time and time again the provisional ballot being very successfully used.
As Senate Democrats name Kay Floyd as their next leader, the Oklahoma City Senator will become the first female leader of either party in the state Senate. Ryan, your thoughts on this pick?
It's historic. You know, Senator Floyd, who used to be my senator before I moved, and I'm grateful for her representation.
Mine too.
She's broke a couple of glass ceilings here. You know, first woman to be elected to lead the Democratic caucus in the House. It's a huge milestone, and also the first member who is identified as LGBTQ that's leading a caucus in the state legislature. And this is a big day. I think that it signals a shift. Or a recognition, at least among Senate Democrats, that new majorities are going to be built out of urban and metropolitan areas, and she certainly has a track record of working with folks to build those majorities and to advance a more progressive agenda. But at the same time, I say a more progressive agenda. Senator Floyd is somebody who is probably one of the most reasonable members in the Oklahoma legislature. She is consistently trying to find opportunities to align different ideologies towards a common goal. And I think that will serve her well in working with a caucus, which, given their numbers, if it's not played correctly, could just be irrelevant. And I mean, she has a big role in making that a relevant caucus, and I think that she'll be successful at that.
Neva, Oklahoma has been around for 111 years, and I was surprised to find out that she is the first woman to be a leader of a party in the state senate.
In the state senate?
Oh, really? I mean, come on.
Well, and I think we only have to look at how few women have served in the state senate and are serving today in the state senate. So I would agree with Ryan. I mean, it is historic, and I think when we look at Senator Floyd's career, while she is one of only eight Democrats among 39 Republicans in the Senate, she has become a very respected member of that body. And I think that in her role now as a leader of the minority party, it affords her the opportunity, hopefully, to be very constructive with the leadership on the Republican side of the aisle next session. And while they will be diametrically opposed on some issues, I think they can forge some common ground and at least build a process where there can be, I think, hopefully the atmosphere that'll be much more productive than we've seen sometimes in the past. So I think it is her level of respect, I think, among her colleagues, both on both sides of the aisle, speaks for itself. And I congratulate her for this, very significant accomplishment that she has.
We can also agree to give her condolences too. I mean,
it's not an headaches that I know she will be facing.
I did actually talk to her earlier this week, and she wanted to talk about trying to bring a little bit more balance to the Senate, which brings bringing more Democrats into the Senate. Do you think that's a possibility of happening with the election coming up?
I mean, I think so. I think that it's certainly the House, or neither the House nor the Senate are poised to shift where you have got Democratic majorities again. But I do think that we have probably seen the high water mark of Republican representation in the Senate. So if she can pick up throughout this campaign cycle a couple of Senate seats, I mean, that would go a long ways towards giving this the Democratic caucus the numbers that it needs to collaborate with a handful of Republicans to get some compromise on some more extreme legislation.
Well, and she's been greatly aided kind of in this election season by the fact that she was unopposed. So sets up for her to be able to go out and work for those folks that are going to be on the ballot on the Democrat side in the Senate this summer and fall. And that's always helpful. I think I think we would see the same out of Senator Treat on his side in terms of helping Republican candidates, and that's one of the roles I think these leaders in their respective parties play in terms of fundraising and just elevating the focus in these particular districts on the significance of their candidates.
I mean, I've already seen some Democratic members. We talked about some of the Democratic members that didn't get opponents in the metropolitan area. And whether that was going to affect turnout. I mean, I think that they're, from visiting with them, they're already out raising money. They've got PACs. They're working with independent expenditures. I mean, they're doing all of the things that they are able to do now because they're not busy with their own campaigns. Kay Floyd, Senator Floyd, now Leader Floyd, is poised to do that as well. So, you know, this idea of getting everybody an opponent, even if you've got just a token opponent, that just sucks up so much of your time and energy. Mm-hmm. And now that they don't have to do that, they're able to go out and focus on some of these other campaigns.
There we go. And Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.